From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Vice President Mike Pence says he wasn't aware that President Trump spoke with Washington Post journalist Bob Woodward 18 times and recorded interviews for Woodward's bombshell new book. In one interview in February, President Trump said he knew how deadly the coronavirus was. On March 19th, the president told Woodward that he publicly downplayed the danger of COVID-19 in order not to panic people.
On Fox News this morning, Pence downplayed those interviews, saying hindsight is 20/20.
I think your viewers deserve to know that when the president made the comment about downplaying on March 19th, that was 4 days after this president ordered us to shut down the entire American economy to put the health of America first.
Joining us now is Washington Post national political reporter Robert Costa. Robert, the president is not denying that he downplayed the dangers of coronavirus publicly while he was saying to Bob Woodward, obviously, that it was very serious. What is the fallout, in your view, from all of this?
He can't deny the comments because the comments are on tape. Bob Woodward recorded the interviews with President Trump, 18 of them. The political consequences to be determined, but what is clear is there is a disconnect between the president's private comments at the time to Woodward versus his public comments, which were much more flippant about the virus, about the severity and scope of the pandemic. And this comes less than 2 months before voters go to the polls, as voting begins very soon in many states across the country. And so this will be processed by millions of Americans as they make their final decision.
Well, and Woodward is going to be on 60 Minutes this weekend. He's going to be on NPR and many other outlets next week. So this story is going to continue to come out. But this is House Speaker Nancy Pelosi speaking this morning about this.
He hid the facts and refused to take the threat seriously, leaving the entire country exposed and unprepared. He didn't want to cause a panic. Why? Because of the stock market? Nobody wants to cause a panic. You want to show leadership. Show a strategic plan.
So that's Nancy Pelosi. We heard Joe Biden yesterday talk about this. What are Republicans on Capitol Hill saying about the news that's come out?
It hasn't caused any significant or even noticeable crack in Republican ranks. This is a party that's in lockstep with the president. They believe he's important for their own political careers as they run for re-election in the House or in the Senate or for governor. They want to make sure the Trump voter comes out. And breaking with the president on the pandemic because of a Bob Woodward book is just not part of the GOP playbook at this time.
Robert, I know that you've been reporting on what is in Woodward's book. What are the other things that stand out to you? Because I'm sure there's going to be more coming out in the days ahead.
The president was warned in late January by his national security advisor, Robert O'Brien. This was the gravest threat he's going to face as president, a national security threat. That comment on February 7th. But you also have the letters from Kim Jong-un to President Trump about the so-called fantasy film type relationship between the two. You have President Trump talking about race, confronted about white privilege by Bob Woodward, a white man of his own generation. And the president saying in a dismissive way to Woodward, you're drinking that Kool-Aid. We see him talking about black Americans like Senator Kamala Harris, the vice presidential nominee for the Democrats, as someone who has a, quote, lot of hate when she looks at President Trump. I could go on and on, but from North Korea to the comments of Dan Coats and Jim Mattis, former Trump administration officials, it's a pretty bleak portrait of the president's character.
Are there still details, do you think, that we don't know about yet that we will soon and that could also be quite shocking?
The only details that we don't know about at this point is the sourcing. And this comes back to the Jeffrey Goldberg article of last week in The Atlantic about the military comments the president allegedly made. You see in this book a lot of interviews done on so-called deep background, which means it's unattributed by Woodward, but it's sourced and quoted just to administration officials. It's going to be interesting to see in the coming weeks, will any people who've served with President Trump, whether it's General Mattis or Dan Coats, step forward, or John Kelly, the former chief of staff, and offer a little bit of commentary to back up what was either in that Atlantic article or in this Bob Woodward book?
Just one more thing, just very briefly. Do you think that the White House is regretting that Trump did these interviews with Woodward?
Well, it wasn't really the White House's decision. What's clear, I've interviewed President Trump with Bob Woodward for The Washington Post. President Trump wanted to talk to Bob Woodward. He wanted a, quote, good book out of him. He says that throughout the book. I wanted a good book out of you, Bob. And you see President Trump acting as he has for much of his own career as his own PR man, mm-hmm. someone who's navigating these interviews on his own, on the phone late at night with Bob Woodward, not sitting in the Oval Office with staff mm-hmm. surrounding them.
Robert Costa of The Washington Post, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, today the Senate rejected that slimmed down Republican coronavirus relief package. Democrats had said with people clamoring for more help, the $300 billion measure was just not enough, dimming hopes for another relief package before November's election. Well, what do small business owners think about all the wrangling on Capitol Hill? Colorado Public Radio's Caitlin Kim visited a small town in northern Colorado to find out.
Hi, how are you, sir?
Hold on, let me cover my face up so you don't know who I am.
Luckily for me, I do know who he is. Troy Hammond, mayor of Wellington, Colorado, a bedroom community of 12,000 people, mostly white, mostly rural, and about an hour's drive north of Denver. I met Hammond last year when Republican Senator Cory Gardner stopped by for one of his Main Street walking tours. The affable Hammond led that tour. Back then, he stressed how fast Wellington was growing. Now, it's a different story.
Well, I'll tell you what, COVID did a lot to our town. Really spun it out, set it back.
Businesses up and down the main street that shuttered have reopened, albeit at smaller capacity and shortened hours. The town helped some of the restaurants expand outdoor seating on the sidewalk. There have been several confirmed cases of COVID-19 here and no deaths. But Hammond says the virus has left other scars.
It's been hard on families and children, not having school to go to and not being able to do the events and plan like they used to. So it was definitely a lifestyle change. And it created a bit of a dystopian society in a small town where everybody knows each other.
Wellington is a town with Republican roots, but more Democrats are moving in as the suburbs stretch outwards. It's welcoming. Neighbors wave or honk when they see one another. And kids' bicycles and toys, not political signs, litter front yards. But Kelly DeVries says there's a sense of uncertainty overhead.
I think everyone's trying to navigate this new environment.
DeVries owns Thistle, a gift shop in town.
And a lot of people are losing jobs or worried that they're going to, so they're holding back more, which totally is understandable.
Despite the sign on her wall that reads, "Please no politics," the registered Democrat says she reached out to some Colorado politicians to talk about the problems facing small businesses like hers. She got a form letter back. And when it comes to this latest round of negotiations in Congress, well,
I don't know. I'm almost to the point where I'm afraid to even hope that there's something out there because it feels like it's so politicized. Instead of it being about picking up America as a whole and picking up each little business.
She's not alone. Peter Pronko and his wife Diana have kept the repair shop of their watch and jewelry business open. The couple are in their 80s, and Proper Time is their retirement business. He's an independent, she's a Democrat. And they both are disappointed by how things have degenerated, especially the latest round of talks.
It's a logjam. It's not going anywhere, which is unfortunate because there's a real need for continuing support of some kind.
He points out that when CARES was passed, people thought it would be a couple of weeks, and then there'd be some sort of long-term plan. There's not, and they're still struggling. Erin Jerome owns the hair salon Trim.
I have clients who are still struggling. I have friends who are still struggling. I have, like, people, you know, downtown here in my community who are still struggling. Restaurants that can only seat half capacity. And, you know, how do you go from 100% income to 50% or even 25%?
Jerome considers herself lucky. Her salon is doing fairly well. But the registered Republican agrees the response from Washington has gotten too partisan.
You know, it's sad to me, too, that things have gotten so Democrat or Republican. What about just that we're all people? What about that we're all just the same group of people? We all pay the same bills. It doesn't matter what your political background is.
And the longer the pandemic goes on, the more frustrated people get. Mary Gray is owner of Soul Squared Brewery and Leave It to Cleaver, a food truck located behind the tap room. The bar used to be packed. Now, capacity is less than 50%. The registered independent, who typically votes Republican, did take some CARES money, but she's worried about the impact on the larger economy.
I mean, $1 trillion, $3 trillion, where's it coming from? Are we just printing fake money at this point? So that part makes me nervous about getting excited about assistance.
And if the political stalemate and finger-pointing continue, Republican Linda Knack, who runs an auto repair shop in town, says everyone will get the blame.
And there's not a lot of feeling of in the middle, you know? Yeah, I think people are pretty set. And I think there's a lot of tunnel vision and earmuffs on that I don't want to hear anymore.
Back at proper time, unaffiliated business owner Peter Pronko is sick of excuses. His message to Congress is clear.
Get your act together. Stop being stupid. I got to admit that I've reached the point of being angry with the way things are being handled all the way around.
Whether or not Congress and the White House get that message remains a big question, one that could have big ramifications for small towns like Wellington, Colorado. For Here and Now, I'm Caitlin Kim.
We now know that President Trump knew in February that the coronavirus was deadly, airborne, and five times worse than the flu, even though publicly he downplayed it and downplayed wearing masks. Well, our next guest has been trying to tell people how serious this pandemic is for a while. She's one of the increasing number of survivors of COVID-19, reporting debilitating medical issues, even though tests show they no longer carry the virus. They call themselves the long haulers. You might remember we spoke with a young doctor 3 months after he was severely ill and then tested negative, technically virus-free. He was still having coughing fits, shortness of breath, and throat spasms that left him unable to work. Well, Diana Berendt, still suffering nearly 7 months after her most severe illness, realized early on that there were others like her and that they had a lot to offer each other and to science. She formed the online group Survivor Corps, whose members document their symptoms, donate their plasma, raise money for treatment and research, and provide support. We spoke to her before the new revelations about what the president knew and when he knew it. I started by asking how she was doing.
I have to tell you, I actually just got back from the eye doctor. My vision hasn't been as good since I've had COVID, and I've had a lot of lingering symptoms, and I've been going to specialist after specialist, and today's news was that I have apparently borderline glaucoma out of nowhere. Which was kind of shocking to learn. I had actually just gone to the eye doctor in January, and the pressure levels were totally normal then, and here we are. And, you know, I was at the gastroenterologist earlier this week. I have an appointment with an ENT and a neurologist next week for the persistent headaches. And I consider myself one of the very lucky ones.
Well, let me ask you, do you hear about vision problems from other long haulers? This is the point, you're comparing notes.
Well, that's the thing. The CDC, when they put out their report saying that 1 in 3 people were not recovering in time, and we have 100,000 people just in Survivor Corps in the country, if we are past 6 million infections, that means that there are, you know, over 2 million people who have not recovered in time from COVID. And the symptoms, as we have found, you know, the CDC listed 12. We did a survey and found 98. And I think that if we were to do that survey again 6 weeks later, it could be double that number. Because as we have learned that it is a vascular disease rather than a respiratory disease, we are seeing damage to almost every organ system. So the ocular issues are coming up, but they're just appearing right now. Most doctors are really, really unfamiliar with the potential effects of the virus. And even those who take it seriously just don't know how to treat all of these various ailments that people are, you know, experiencing in the aftermath of COVID.
Well, you're right. The CDC says a third of the people who've had COVID-19 are having long-term effects. A fifth of those are young people with no pre-existing conditions. The average long hauler is 44. That's you. But there are 25-year-olds who are marathon runners. So what are some of the things they're experiencing?
The most common things that we're seeing are prolonged respiratory issues, a very concerning degree of neurological issues. So brain fog, headaches, the kind of soul-crushing headaches that leave you under the covers in the dark, unable to function. We are seeing things as dramatic as post-COVID onset diabetes and lupus. We're seeing people in tremendous pain, inflammation of the joints. We're seeing skin issues. We're seeing people with tachycardia is a very common after effect.
Tachycardia, that's when your heart starts to beat at over 100 beats a minute, and it, you know, could lead to stroke or heart attack.
you know, really there's not a single organ that is not being affected by this virus. Yeah. As a country, we are doing, you know, an adequate job of tracking infections, tracking hospitalization, and tracking mortality. But what it's missing is the 95% of people who are not hospitalized. They are being told to stay at home under no medical supervision with Tylenol and Gatorade, and to only seek medical help if they truly cannot breathe and need to be admitted to the emergency room. I mean, this is the first time in any of our collective experience where you would get sick, dramatically so, and be told to not go to the doctor. What we found at Survivor Corps, because I started it on March 24th, so we've sort of been the canary in the COVID coal mine, so to speak. So we started to see by the end of April that there were people who were not recovering. The impacts of this are just so far-reaching. Their ability to work, their ability to function in society, their mental health. It is really a huge public health crisis that we are staring down.
We know you've partnered with the University of Indiana. They've published a report using your data. You're also, as we just heard, advocating for post-COVID care. Mount Sinai in New York City has a post-COVID care center. But what is it that you want to see?
So I have been very lucky in that I actually am a patient now at Mount Sinai's post-COVID care center, but it's the type of care that is not available to really just about anyone in the country. We need to have centers like Mount Sinai's replicated everywhere.
What do they do?
The main thing is that they take you seriously. Many of our members are complaining. They describe it as being gaslit by their doctors. They're going in with severe medical conditions, and they're being told that they're having an anxiety attack. And yeah, they probably are having anxiety, but they're also having tachycardia. And they need to be treated medically and taken seriously. And so it was such a phenomenal relief to walk through those doors and have a doctor sit down with me for an hour and 45 minutes and listen to everything that I've gone through, and then referred me out to various specialists. It is really a model of what needs to be available to everybody. And so partnering with Dr. Lambert at IU School of Medicine, we are actually just wrapping up our second study. This is a really deep dive into every symptom that a person had, how long they had it for, in what order, did it come, did it go, what medications were they on beforehand. So it would be very interesting to know if people who were on blood thinners beforehand had an easier time. We are seeing that there could be a connection between certain MS drugs that could be protective against COVID. So trying to put together these disparate data points and try to tell a cohesive story about what is happening and maybe understand a little bit about why it's happening.
I mean, it's kind of crazy because this is what the medical system usually does.
Right. It's not usually, you know, a suburban mom who takes it upon themselves to do such a thing. Right. No, this is these are not usual times.
Yeah, no, they're not. We know you're also organizing plasma donations. We know that post-COVID blood has antibodies in it. There's question as to how effective it is as a treatment, but it's still an important item, and you're organizing that.
Yeah. Our mission has actually remained the same since the day I started Survivor Corps while I was in isolation in my bedroom with COVID, and that is to mobilize an army of COVID survivors to donate their plasma and to support science in every way possible. We have a Facebook group that's open to everybody. And we also have a website, survivorcorps.com, which is basically a one-stop shop of how you can give back. Because if you have had COVID, you have superpowers inside of you. This virus is a mystery, but the answers to that mystery lie in the bodies of survivors. It is a moral imperative to engage in every single scientific research study for which we qualify.
Diana Behrendt, we're going to hook people up to Survivor Corps at herenow.org. I just have to ask, it's one of those things where people say it's a club you don't want to join, but it sounds like it is. If you are post-COVID, what a great support group. What happens Do people leave? Do people say, hey, I'm better?
Well, one problem is that they're not actually getting better. The people who are experiencing these long-haul symptoms, and it's a huge, huge number, most of them are not better yet. We're seeing people who are experiencing it chronically, and then we're seeing people who have symptomatic relapses. It's a very deceptive recovery, because just when you think that you're on the other side, it rears its ugly head again. And it's true, I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. But I will say, on a positive note, that Survivor Corps is really an extraordinary virtual place. It is the most civil, supportive, caring community that exists among 100,000 strangers in America right now.
Well, and I'm imagining, you know, it's a club you don't want to join, but I bet people are desperate for it just to hear that they are not alone in this.
Absolutely. I mean, having COVID and, you know, people are isolated at home and they're scared. And there's never been more of a need for a community like this. But what's amazing is to see the level of support and to see people being raised up as superheroes every time they go and donate plasma, and they post their donor selfies and they get hundreds of likes. People ask me all the time, what do I tell, you know, my uncle who thinks it's a hoax? And the answer is very simple. Come on over to Survivor Corps and read these stories. And I promise he'll change his mind.
Diane, I wish you all the best, and we wish you better health, and to all of your members. We just think about you, and thank you so much for telling us about what you're doing.
Thank you so much for bringing light to such an important subject. We're so appreciative.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Wednesday, September 16th from 9 to 10 a.m. sdm.mit.edu.
An official at the Department of Homeland Security says political appointees in the Trump administration ordered him to downplay the threat of Russia's interference in the upcoming election and to downplay threats from white supremacy to better serve the political interests of the president. For more on this, let's bring in NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie. Greg, there's a lot in this new complaint, but first let's start with the whistleblower himself, Brian Murphy. Who is he and why is he coming forward right now?
Brian Murphy was the head of the intelligence branch at Homeland Security, and that's an operation that usually doesn't get very much attention. But he cropped up in the news in July. At that time, the Washington Post reported he was directing a DHS effort to follow the social media accounts of journalists who were covering the protests out in Portland, Oregon. Now, he says this is not accurate. He's disputing this. Nonetheless, he was removed from that post in July and given an administrative job that he says is a demotion. He says the real reason he was moved because he was complaining about DHS leadership.
And he says that on at least two separate occasions, he was told to downplay the danger of Russian interference in the election. What does he say about that?
So he says the acting head of DHS, Chad Wolf, told him this in May and again in July. And Wolf apparently told him that this was something that made President Trump look bad. Wolf also said, according to the complaint, that this was coming from the White House. Now, the DHS denies all this, but as we well know, President Trump has repeatedly challenged intelligence, saying that Russia helped him in 2016 and may well be doing it again this year.
And DHS is not the only intelligence agency or only agency of the government that is involved in looking into stuff like Russian election interference. Give us some perspective on the role they play in the intelligence community.
Sure. So the DHS role is relatively small, and no one is suggesting that they found some major Russian plot that's being covered up. So they're not one of the big players, but they do play a crucial role in disseminating the intelligence community findings and sharing it with states, local law enforcement. And so that's where they do play a very important role.
The other thing that I mentioned from this whistleblower was that he said he was told to downplay the threat of white nationalism in the United States and focus instead on the threat of leftists, militant movements like Antifa. What do we know about that?
So Brian Murphy says he was told that any reports on these matters should be in sync with what President Trump was saying publicly. Again, DHS is denying this, but with our own eyes, we've seen the Trump administration talk much more about threats on the far left, even though analysts say the evidence shows that, that groups on the far right have been involved in many more violent episodes.
What happens now with this? I know Democrats are requesting that Murphy testify before the House Intelligence Committee behind closed doors this month.
So I won't try to predict the outcome of this specific case, but the Democrats say that this points to this larger issue that the Trump administration is trying to politicize the intelligence community, raising questions about the way the administration is handling sensitive information that could be election related.
That is Greg Myrie, NPR National Security Correspondent. Greg, thank you.
My pleasure.
President Trump has been touting law and order as a cornerstone of his reelection campaign, saying that crime is surging in cities and calling for federal law enforcement to intervene. But what's true? Joining us now is Richard Rosenfeld, who's Emeritus Professor of Criminology and Criminal Justice at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Professor, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Well, and what do we know at this point about the latest crime statistics that are available? What kind of crime is increasing, how much, and where?
What we know as of now is that violent crime rates have been increasing in many big cities across the country over the last several months. Property crime rates, however, have been declining. But violent crime rates are up. They did not start going up in early March. In most places, they didn't begin to increase until the last week of May and the first few days of June. And that increase coincided with the emergence of social unrest and protests associated with the George Floyd killing in Minneapolis.
And you say that property crime is not up, but violent crime is up. What does that tell you?
Well, the decline in property crime tells me that the actions taken to address the COVID-19 pandemic produced declines in property crime. Residential burglary, for example, went way down. More people were staying at home, and burglars tend to avoid occupied households. There's no shoplifting when the shops are closed. Explaining the rise in violent crime is a bit more complex. I think we all have to grapple with the fact that the rise in violent crime does or did coincide pretty closely with the emergence of street demonstrations and other protests associated with police violence, in particular the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. So how do we understand that connection in time? Part of it, I think, goes back to the pandemic. The pandemic had really sizable impacts on police presence and police activity. Officers were out on quarantine because they had the virus or they were exposed to someone who had the virus. And of those officers who remained on the job, it's pretty clear that there was a dramatic reduction in contacts between the police and the public. Fewer stops for traffic violations, fewer stops of pedestrians on the street, fewer stops of occupied vehicles. And those are some of the actions that police take when they're out on patrol that can help to reduce crime. I think, and here one has to speculate, but I think what's happening is a change in community dynamics amid widespread protests over police violence. And I'm talking specifically about disadvantaged communities of color, where historically relationships with the police have been tense, fraught. Mm-hmm. And if those tensions exist to the point that people really begin drawing away from the police, less likely to contact the police when a crime occurs, even when they're the victim, less likely to cooperate with the police. What tends to happen in that void, as people are drawing back, is that so-called street justice fills the void. People take matters into their own hands to settle disputes. They're more likely to under those conditions, and violence goes up. So I think that's the explanation, certainly I would pursue, for why we saw violent crime increase when we did.
But when we talk about an increase in violent crime, over the past few decades, since the early 90s, it's actually been going down in the United States. Is the recent increase compared to 6 months ago, a year ago, a decade ago, really that big?
Certainly, it is significantly larger in my own research than last year. But you're quite correct to point out that the long-term trend has been a sizable decline in violent crime, including homicide. No city, to my knowledge, is anywhere near the level of homicide or other violent crime it was experiencing in the early 90s.
One of the things I remember from my time as a local reporter covering all kinds of local issues, including crime, is that it always goes up in the summertime, often because people have more time on their hands. And of course, in the world of COVID-19, people also, in many cases, have more time on their hands. Does that figure in, do you think?
Yeah, well, certainly there is a strong seasonal component to the kinds of street crimes that we're talking about. So what we're talking about is increases in violence that ordinarily occur during this point in the year, but that are larger this year than we've seen in the recent past.
You know, another thing that I've been reading about as a possible reason, some people are making this claim that this is a possible reason for an increase in crime, is the change in bail laws and cash bail laws in some places. Can you explain what that means and whether you think that is a reason for the increase in crime?
It's possible, although I have yet to see direct evidence linking bail reform and reductions in jail populations to the increase in violent crime that we've been seeing. You know, most people are not in jail for having committed a violent crime. And the bail reform laws really, to the degree that they're at all effective, are resulting in the release of people who are in jail for lesser crimes, such as property crime. But as we already discussed, property crime rates have not been going up. And I would also add that there are many cities in which we're seeing increases in violence that have not experienced anything like bail reform. So I think that case is yet to be proved.
I want to listen to President Trump in July saying something that he said many times, talking about sending federal law enforcement to cities. Listen.
Chicago should be calling us, and so should Philadelphia and Detroit and others, to go in and really help them. Because when you're losing many people a weekend, many, many people, you see the same numbers as I do. When you're losing these people, they should call us and they should say, come on in. And it's incredible to me, but they're not doing it. At some point they will. At some point we may have no other choice but to go in.
Is there evidence that local and state police departments can't handle this increase in crime and that it helps to have the federal government send in forces to help deal with it?
My short response would be no. Especially if the people being sent in do not know the local terrain and have not been trained, as local officers have, in the strategies and tactics of so-called smart policing. I don't see what additional benefits will come from just sending in dozens into the hundreds of federal agents into the cities. As we saw in Portland, Portland then asked them to go, and they did leave, evidently without having much of an impact.
Well, isn't part of the issue also that people who are in the community, the local police officers, don't want to get involved in First Amendment disputes with people who are out there protesting and have to come down and say, no, you can't do that? Is that outside of their wheelhouse? But is a federal agent going to be any better at that either?
Oh, I don't think so. Let's go back to Portland as the example. The ostensible reason for bringing in the federal agents to Portland was to protect federal property. But what we saw in Portland is once the federal agents were in Portland, they began to fan out well beyond federal property that was under some threat. And that's what I would question. I question its effectiveness. It tended to aggravate, not calm, the situation in Portland.
What do you think about people's fears? Clearly, President Trump and Republicans believe that voters are worried about public safety and crime and may vote on that issue because they think it'll make them safer if there's more of a law enforcement presence. Is that fear rational right now, given the statistics that you're looking at?
The fear may be overblown. But regardless of the level of fear, the question, the political question, is whether that fear is going to translate into votes for the president or for Vice President Biden. And the polling data I've seen suggests that people are more apt to hold the president responsible for stoking that fear and for overall conditions in some of the cities where there have been looting and riots. And it makes quite a bit of sense. It's the president who's in charge. This is not Joe Biden's America as of yet. And so while I think the fear may be overblown to the degree it's there, it's not at all clear that it's going to redound to the president's favor in the election.
That is Richard Rosenfeld, who's an emeritus professor of criminology and criminal justice at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Professor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The Trump administration has been rolling back Obama-era regulations meant to help reduce climate change, claiming that will spur the economy. But according to a report from the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, a government agency, the exact opposite will happen. The report concludes that climate change is the major threat to the U.S. financial system and the American economy, not the regulations to curb it. And it cites drought, flooding, fires. As places in the West burn, the report points to the first climate change-related bankruptcy, the utility PG&E, last year after wildfires, and offers dozens of policy recommendations, including climate-related stress tests for banks. For more on this first-of-its-kind bipartisan federal report, we're joined by Skype by the chair of that panel that produced it, Robert Litterman. He's a founding partner of the investment firm Kepos Capital. Bob, welcome.
Thank you.
And we know that there were dozens of analysts from top firms, academic experts, a lot of input into this report. Paint us your picture of how climate change-related events could impact the financial markets.
You know, that's a great question. There are so many potential scenarios, and I can't tell you exactly what's going to happen. There's so many different dimensions to it. The human dimension, the health impact, national security dimension to it. What we focused on was not so much the broad impacts to the economy, what could happen to the financial system, and what could happen to banks, asset valuations, and so on. And the fundamental problem is that we're not pricing the risk. We have to create those appropriate incentives to reduce emissions.
Well, you talk about pricing the risk. You say we're not pricing carbon at its true cost, either through taxes on people who are emitters or a credit system so polluters can buy and sell credits. This has been talked about for decades. And this was a Commodities Commission commissioned report. And we're thinking of a derecho that just flattened the corn crop. You talk about banks in the Midwest. In other words, when a corn crop is flattened, maybe banks will not make loans. I mean, take it further into the financial system.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. We worry about different kinds of risks, transition risks, which are associated with moving to the low carbon economy, and also physical risks, such as the droughts, the rains, hurricanes, and so on. And these can be both systemic for the entire financial system, or they can be subsystemic. You could have a drought in a particular area in the Midwest that would really be devastating to that region and the banks in that region. We could have events that happen one after the other that over time weaken the financial system. The climate-related events could compound other impacts, such as the COVID pandemic. These are all the kinds of things that could happen, and we have to be prepared.
Well, in fact, your report and people on the panel have compared this to the coronavirus and this idea that it becomes a contagion. So you mentioned banks. If there's a drought, banks might have to limit loans. Home values plummet after events like fires, floods, droughts. That means that towns don't get the tax revenue that they expected. Insurance companies could completely withdraw from California. You're talking about the whole financial system being impacted. Why isn't this scene? I mean, is part of the problem here that people too often look at the stock market and think that that will tell us how the financial system is doing when often it's a false prophet?
I think that we are seeing the impacts of climate, and I think people understand it. I think there's a collective action problem here. You know, we've seen a lot of actually very important lessons come out of the COVID crisis, and they apply to climate as well. And one of those lessons is that we're all part of an interdependent society. And, you know, the urgency of addressing these risk management crises. Time is a scarce resource when you're trying to manage risk. If we have enough time, we can solve a problem. But as with COVID, we kind of blew it in the first couple of weeks, and then it was impossible to wind back the clock. The same thing could happen with respect to climate. I hope it's not too late, but we won't know for decades, you know, what the impacts of what we do today are. We have to take action urgently. That's one of the key messages from this report.
Well, for instance, the report is calling for the reversal of the rule that's being proposed by the Trump administration's Labor Department. We've spoken about it here. It would forbid retirement investment managers from considering environmental consequences in their financial recommendations. And as your report points out, part of this financial infrastructure you're talking about is retirement plans, pension plans. But how do you get the current administration to reverse that thinking, to get them to understand that investment managers have to consider environmental consequences?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that makes this report so powerful is that it was a consensus document. We had support not only from, you know, environmental organizations and academics, but also from banks, from insurance companies, from oil companies. This is something that everyone in the financial markets understands now. They agree on it. There's so much that we do agree on. This is a roadmap for how to move forward to provide insurance that the financial markets don't, you know, run into the kinds of problems that we might if we ignore this problem.
Robert Littleman, founding partner of the investment firm Keppos Capital, who led the panel within the Commodity Futures Trading Commission that produced this report on how climate change is threatening the financial markets. Bob, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.